Robert Badgerow is the first person in Canada to be tried four times for the same first-degree murder. The Hamilton Spectator has told the story from the very beginning. I'm David Crosby, and this is part three of Covering Diane, a Spectator serial podcast about nearly four decades of our coverage of one murder. Diane Rowendowitz has been dead longer than she was ever alive. And yet, in the pages of the Hamilton Spectator, she is made to breathe again, if only for the length of a story or within the borders of a photograph. The young nursing assistant was on the eve of her 23rd birthday when she left a Stony Creek bar for a short walk home. She never made it. Her body was found face down in a creek. She had been raped, strangled, and drowned. That was 1981. Over the years, it is easy for a life to fade away into a statistic, for one murder victim to blur into another. Those at the Spec who have covered Diane's homicide have never lost sight of the fact that she was a daughter, a friend, a woman who should have had her whole life ahead of her. That compassion began with Hank Denishevsky, a Spec summer intern who happened to be working the weekend Diane was killed. It would be the first pickup of his career, and one that would result in his being subpoenaed as a crown witness at four murder trials decades after the fact. A pickup is one of the toughest assignments for a journalist. It means going to the family of someone who has recently died, requesting an interview, and picking up a photograph of the deceased to be published with a story. Denishevsky was conflicted about doing pickups then, and that hasn't changed much as he nears the end of his journalism career.
I just think, we have to tread a very fine line as journalists with, getting the story, getting the information, and intruding on the privacy of someone.
There wasn't much more written about Diane until 17 years later, when the police launched the Ravine Rapist Task Force in a hunt for Diane's killer, whom they also believed was a serial rapist. It was when Robert Badgerow went on trial for the first time in 2001 for Diane's first-degree rape and murder that a portrait of her really started to emerge. The Spec's court reporter at the time, Barbara Brown, wrote those stories. Columnist Susan Claremont asked her about that.
And what about for you personally, Barb? I know one of the things that I have always admired about you and the way you did your job is that you never forgot about the victims. And, you never met Diane Rowendowitz.
But I did get a sense of her.
Yes. And so how, first of all, how do you do that when you're sitting in a courtroom seeing things like autopsy photos and hearing, disturbing, difficult evidence from those children who found her body? How do you restore a sense of dignity to a victim? And why does that matter? Why is that important?
Well, why it's important, I got my sense of who Diane was from her friends. They were repeatedly called to testify about who she was. They were there at the preliminary hearings. They all got up and testified. They were there at the first trial. They all got up and testified. And each time they testified, maybe something was added to the profile of who she was. And what I came away with was, here was a young nursing student. She wasn't a student. I think she was a nursing assistant. That's what they called them, an RNA. She was a serious and sober person. She wasn't foolhardy. She wasn't reckless. She wasn't a party girl. She didn't really want to go out that night. And I think the thing that sort of broke my heart about her was that she just went out as a favor to her friends that Friday night and left early because she wasn't really having a very good time, and walked home. It was a neighborhood pub, and people didn't think about assaults and rapists lurking in the woods. Back in those days, it's what, 36 years ago? People walked around and she was just going home and someone, namely the convicted man, Robert Badgero, decided that her life would end that night. And it still makes me angry to think that someone could be so arrogant to think that they could, you know, take away her dignity, take her life, and leave her discarded face down in the creek. Yeah, I just can't imagine how anyone could do that.
When the coverage of the third and fourth trials were passed to Claremont, she made a point of keeping Diane at the center of every column. For years, she kept photos of Diane pinned up at her desk, including the graduation photo that summer intern Hank Danishevsky had picked up from the family all those years ago.
Pickups are tough, but tremendously important. I couldn't do them if I didn't see the value in them. They're the difference between a nameless statistic and a real person who has been lost.
Carl Rowendowitz is Diane's nephew. He was 10 when his aunt was murdered. Growing up with his family's distinct name as it pops up in the news has often left him angry at the media. He recalls seeing the Hamilton Spectator just after his aunt's homicide.
The first time I saw the newspaper probably was a couple days later when I went to my friend's house and the newspaper was facing up, and then I walked in and then the people stopped talking and then the newspaper was there and then they flipped the newspaper. And then that's, you know, I knew it was, I already knew it was in the paper because my dad was pretty upset about it. It bothers you because it's your personal life for everybody to see. You know, it's personal and we don't talk about it. Right. It's people just think that because it's in the newspaper that you want to talk about. It. Right. It's freely there for people to discuss. And to you, it's something that's really bad happened. Right. And you're trying to get your head around it. And meanwhile, people are talking about it. You know, that was the biggest thing I had was walking in the room. People would stop talking. It's such a private thing to you. You feel, I was thinking about this last night. You don't feel ashamed, but it's like feeling ashamed. It's so interpersonal that you just don't want to talk about it.
Carl is still angry about an unwanted phone call he received years ago from a reporter at a Toronto paper.
26 years old or whatever, on a Saturday evening when I had a bunch of people over my house having a party. She called me up, and that's when I was unlisted for the longest time. And I just had enough of it because I got friends in school, you know, whatever. I got all these friends where I live, but I'm not listed, right? And that was before the internet. That was before smartphones. That was before everything else where you actually had to use a phone book to look people up. And people are like, you know, they try to look you in the phone. I try to look you up. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm not there. And then you kind of have to shrug it off. Like, why you're not in the, you know, why aren't you listed, right? Because people question that. Why aren't you listed in the phone book? So I had enough. I just want to be like everybody else. So I listed myself in the phone book. And like I said, it was Saturday night and house party starting, phone rings, I answer and the lady's like, hi, I'm from the Star and I forget what her name is. And she goes, do you know that they just arrested your aunt's murderer? And I didn't know that. Well, I'm in a room with a bunch of people, right? And so I'm like, you know, I didn't know what to say. I was more in shock than anything.
For decades, the Rowendowitz family had been reticent about talking to the media. Members of the family, and it is a very small family, attended the first trial. But due to health issues, stress, and their dislike of the media, they did not attend the second or third trials. So when Carl came to the fourth trial, he met Susan Claremont for the first time. He wouldn't speak with her at first, but as the trial went on, that changed. Carl tells Susan why.
I don't think there was anything wrong with your story. If I would have had a problem with your story, then I would have told you. People need to know what's going on, and I wouldn't argue that fact. And they didn't need to know about the injustice in the courtroom, or they need to know about, you know, this is what you shouldn't do, right? You shouldn't go out nighttime. You shouldn't walk through a park by yourself. And, you know, there's things that you shouldn't do. And these are the things I need to explain to my daughters as they get older. You know, they've already brought up the fact, and they, you know, my oldest daughter, they were doing name searches, and she came home one day and told me that she saw me on the internet. And she wanted to know about it, so I have to explain to her somehow. And I told her, well, I'll tell you this, and later I'll tell you some more.
Claremont eventually won Carl's trust. So much so that he sat down with her for a long, emotional interview before the end of the fourth trial, sharing family photos of Diane that had never before been made public. Moments after the guilty verdict at the last trial, Carl and his mother, Lorraine, embraced Claremont and thanked her for keeping Diane in everyone's thoughts. Of course, Robert Badgerow is the other half of this story. Journalists need to be legally and ethically fair to him, but they must also be honest. At Badgerow's first trial, former court reporter Barbara Brown began to give readers some insight into what the steelworker was like around the time of the Ravine rapist attacks and Diane's murder in 1981.
Robert Badgerow at the time of these events was 23. So, you know, they're all about the same age. They all live in and around Stony Creek. And he was known as, back in those days, as someone who would take off out of the house and go on a night prowl. Like, you know, he'd say he was going out running but he'd be gone for, you know, hours at a time in the dark. And that was something that was noted by wives and girlfriends.
Brown spent hundreds of hours in a courtroom with Badgerow.
Oh, I spoke with him, you know, at the courthouse on a number of occasions, but I never interviewed him. There was always, you know, the next trial coming up and... No, I never interviewed him, but I did get, you know, a good chance to observe him. I mean, he was not outrageous as in any sense of the word, you know, as some accused can be. He was mild-mannered, polite. Yeah, I wouldn't say that there was anything remarkable about him. He was a big guy, beefy. He had a reputation among DeFasco steelworkers for being a bit of a acrobat, you know, swinging from these high rafters or climbing on these high beams up in the hot mill. Very strong, very beefy. And he remained that way most of his life. Friends, not friends, but a couple of women that I had spoke to on numerous occasions because they knew Badgerow from Stony Creek and they attended the trials, said that one night they were driving up Barton Street, I think it was, in Stony Creek, and suddenly, boom, this figure falls from the sky in front of their car while they're stopped at a red light and, you know, just completely freaks them out. And they realize it's Robert Badgerow who's been climbed up a pole, a light standard, and is swinging from the red light lamp and falls down to the road in front of them. That's how strong he is. And kind of a, you know, practical joker he tried to scare them, and he did. They were quite alarmed. The stories about him were a little bit off. People said that he was prone to road rage. You know, he would get into big fights in the parking lot or on the road. But in the courthouse, in my encounters with him, he was always quiet and polite.
Jurors were asked to pay close attention to Badgerow's voice. They were asked to compare what they heard on the now infamous 911 call to a video of Badgerow giving a speech at his first wedding. Listen carefully to the voices in these two recordings.
It's times like this when the guy really knows who his friends are. I'd like to thank Bernie and Beth for one of their three notes of letters. And I'd like to thank all the guys that were at the wedding party. Especially Ed. I'm glad everybody's enjoying the meal. And I'd like to thank the bridesmaids. All of them, in my opinion, are very beautiful.
This place?
Yes.
I got information on how that girl was killed in Barton Lake.
What's your name?
It's not important.
Okay, what's the information?
She was raped before she was killed. She was wearing blue jeans, a white top, and a red or orange top over top of the white top. Blonde hair, about 5'11". She was found face down in the creek with a tire on top of her shoulders and head.
Yeah.
And that's about all I can tell you.
Times like this, the guy really knows who his friends are. And
I got information on how that girl was killed in Barton and Lake.
I'd like to thank Bernie and Beth for one of their three notes of letters.
She was raped before she was killed. She was wearing blue jeans, a white top, and a red or orange top over top of the white top.
And I'd like to thank all the guys that were at the wedding party.
She was found face down in the creek with a tire on top of her shoulders and head.
And I'd like to thank the bridesmaids. All of them, in my opinion, are very beautiful.
And, that's about all I can tell you.
And
she was strangled with her purse.
Though Badgerow had always been cordial with the media covering his case, he became particularly friendly with Claremont. He would go out of his way to speak to her at court, politely holding doors open for her or offering to pour her a glass of water. He would engage in sometimes lengthy conversations about traffic and the weather, and even his own family. He made a point of introducing his family members to her.
I don't know why Robert Badgerow talks to me. I don't know. It's a mystery to me. I don't know if it's just his personality, and maybe he talks to everybody and is friendly with everybody. I don't know. It's yet another mystery.
That mystery deepened in the final days of the fourth trial while the jury was deliberating. Years prior, while Badgerow was incarcerated, Claremont paid him a visit at the Hamilton Wentworth Detention Center. Badgerow was serving out the sentence meted at his first trial, waiting to hear the results of his appeal. Claremont wanted to know if he would grant her an interview. As they spoke over handheld receivers through a pane of glass, he declined to talk then.
He said, but I'll tell you this. When this is all over, I will tell you the whole story.
In December 2016, as the jury was deliberating during the fourth trial, Claremont had asked Badgerow if he remembered their conversation years previous, and if he would supply that interview now. He again declined. Claremont was working in a designated media office in the Kitchener Courthouse as they waited for the jury's verdict.
The door was closed, but there was a window on the door, and there was a knock, and I looked up, and it was Robert Badgerow standing outside the door. So I motioned for him to come in, and he did. He came in and he closed the door behind him, and he said that he was there to apologize. And I had no idea for what. And he said, I think I was a bit rude to you earlier when you came in and spoke to me. He said, you caught me a little bit off guard, and I was concerned about the way I responded to you. And I assured him that he hadn't been rude to me, because he hadn't been at all. And he said, you know, I'm just, you know, it's a little bit stressful right now. And I wanted to tell you that I've thought about it. And yes, I would sit down with you for an interview after the verdict if I'm found not guilty.
Outside of one media scrum on the day his charge was stayed, Badgerow had never done an interview.
And I thought that, you know, he delivered the message that he was there to give me. But then a really strange thing happened, and he just kept talking and talking and talking.
The conversation lasted nearly 2 hours and ranged from his history of athleticism to his favorite music, his reputation as a tough guy, to his regrets about the effects of the trials on his family.
Part of me was thinking, holy shit, I can't believe he's standing here telling me all this. And you know, just didn't want to interrupt, didn't want to sort of break, you know, that moment, whatever it was that was compelling him to be there talking to me. I didn't want to affect that. And there were a couple of times when he easily could have sort of snapped to and realized, you know, that maybe that wasn't a good idea. One was when the homicide detectives on that case kept walking back and forth outside the window of the door and like trying to get my attention. And I completely understood what they were doing. They were concerned about me being in this little tiny office alone with Robert Badger with the door closed in the basement of the courthouse. And they were keeping an eye on me, making sure I was okay. So another moment when Badgero could have easily just walked out and ended that conversation was at one point, the door sort of suddenly opens and it's Badgero's lawyer, Russell Silverstein, walks in with this look of absolute surprise on his face.
Yeah.
And he says, what is going on in here? What's like, it was like this WTF moment. Like, what is happening? I looked to Badgero and let Badgero answer. And Badgero said to his own lawyer, he said, everything is fine. We're just having a conversation. And essentially dismissed his lawyer.
So why did Badgero talk to Claremont? What compelled him at this point to have a one-on-one with the journalist?
I think he needed me. I think he needed I think he needed someone to talk to. I mean, the reality is this was an unbelievably stressful point in his life. He's waiting for a verdict in his fourth murder trial. I think he also, in some ways, needed me to tell his story. You know, sometime down the road was what he was thinking, but I had other ideas around that. Because if he was convicted and was sent to prison, then I wouldn't have that opportunity for a sit-down interview. If he was found not guilty, then I would wait for a sit-down interview.
When Badgero left the room, Claremont immediately wrote down everything she could remember, just in case he was found guilty and she would never get the chance at that long-awaited interview. A couple of days after the conversation, the jury came back with its decision. It was about 6 o'clock in the evening when the verdict came in.
So I was sitting in the courtroom and the jury comes in, and it always happens very quickly. Once a jury's in the courtroom, there's not a lot of, I think it surprises people, there's not a lot of pomp and circumstance. It's the judge, you know, gets down to business very, very quickly, because it's absolute torture for the jurors, for the accused, for everybody. So the jury foreperson stands and says, we find Robert Badgero guilty of first degree murder. And a moment later, Badgero is asked if he has anything he wants to say. And he does. And he gets up. And what he says is unlike anything I've ever heard in a courtroom before. He starts by apologizing to his ex-wife, both of his ex-wives, and his ex-lover, all of whom have been talked about a lot during the trials. And Badgero had actually told me when we were in the office that day, he told me that this was one of his biggest regrets in life, that the women in his life, excluding, of course, Diane Rowendowitz, because he didn't consider her a woman in his life, but the women that he had loved and who had been in his life, he regretted that they had been put through hell because of his case. So that in itself, you know, my head's kind of reeling at this point. It's I'm trying to really intently listen to everything he's saying, while at the same time, I'm trying to observe everybody and everything that's happening in the courtroom. I want to look and see the jurors' faces. I want to see Badgero's son is in the courtroom and he is devastated. He's bent over, seated in one of the benches at the front of the courtroom, and he's sobbing and he is just devastated by what's happening to his father. I'm trying to tweet. I'm trying to, observe I'm looking behind me to see these homicide detectives who've been on this case for forever and see their reaction. I'm looking at the lawyers trying to get what's going on inside their heads. And in the midst of all of that, Robert Badgerill starts talking about me. He says he wants to thank Susan Claremont from the Hamilton Spectator. And I can't even believe that I'm hearing this. And he said something like, I don't always agree with what she writes, but I respect her as a person. I think what he's saying is what I actually think our relationship is about. I think we have somehow weirdly managed to have this mutual respect for each other, which, to some people might seem appalling, right? There may be people who think that that's disgusting that I've shown respect for Robert Badgerill. But Robert has noticed it and seems to have appreciated it, and it seems to have been reciprocated by him. So that was, he's got this chance before being taken off to prison to say whatever he wants to say. And one of the things he chooses to talk about is me.
Next time on Covering Diane.
Covering crimes, especially one like this, is a real challenge because the public expect fairness, and yet they want to be informed. And I think the role of a good reporter is never put to a better test than in this context, because they have to not only dig out interesting stuff and yet be fair enough, but they also have to obey a bunch of rules, some of which really don't make any sense.
Covering Diane is a serial podcast produced by David Crosby and Susan Claremont at the Hamilton Spectator.